it's not coming from Brent Veach and Andy Reid, and it's not coming from Sean McVay. It's coming from the Cleveland Browns. And yeah. You're seeing exactly
you know
what
why
people
it's not,
outside of Cleveland
you know,
think of the Browns, outside of
you
Browns
know
fans.
Why it's not coming from those guys? Because they didn't draft him. They didn't want him to begin with. This was the one team that wanted him, and they're telling you he's behind. Maybe it's not a grand conspiracy. Maybe everybody is right, and the Shador fans, you wackos, maybe it's your guy is just not ready. Maybe you got to come to grips with it.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
At Blinds.com, it's not just about window treatments. It's about you, your style, your space, your way. Whether you DIY or want the pros to handle it all, you'll have the confidence of knowing it's done right. From free expert design help to our 100% satisfaction guarantee, everything we do is made to fit your life and your windows. Because at Blinds.com, the only thing we treat better than windows is you. Visit Blinds.com now for up to 45% off with minimum purchase, plus a professional measure at no cost. Rules and restrictions apply.
Tito's Handmade Vodka is America's favorite vodka for a reason. From the first legal distillery in Texas, Tito's is 6 times distilled till it's just right. And naturally gluten-free, making it a high-quality spirit that mixes with just about anything. From the smoothest martinis to the best Bloody Marys. Tito's is known for giving back, teaming up with nonprofits to serve its communities and do good for dogs. Make your next cocktail with Tito's. Distilled and bottled by 5th Generation Inc., Austin, Texas. 40% alcohol by volume. Savor responsibly.
Swinging a high drive into center field, hits at the wall, it is gone! Cassis does it again!
Again!
It's gone! It's into the bullpen! This game is tied! This game is tied!
And he swings and rips one to center field. It's high, it's deep, it's back, it's gone! Sale winds, he fires. Swing and a miss, Frank Lee, it's over! The Red Sox have won the World Championship!
All right, let's hit it. Play Tessie, episode 262. This is the official Red Sox podcast of WEEI. Before we get going, hit that subscribe button wherever you get your podcasts. Rate 5 stars. You know the drill. We're on WEEI's YouTube channel. You can subscribe to WEEI. You can find all the Play Tessie episodes in the Play Tessie podcast playlist. Hit the thumbs up on those videos and then find us on the socials. At Play Tessie, Twitter, Instagram, TikTok. Here with Sammy, here with Pat, and I've said it a million times. I'll say it again. I hate when they win the first two and then lose the last one because it just and it's the same the other way around. I've talked about it a million times, but like I'm in the moment. Like the game ended what? 3 hours ago? 2 hours ago? About 2 hours ago. Game ended 2 hours ago. I'm frustrated because they could have won the game. They should have won the game. They were 2-for-16 with runners in scoring position and were still in a position to potentially win the game. Obviously, Chapman lets up his first hit in 50 batters and lets in the run, but that's not why they lost. It was the 2-for-16 with runners in scoring position. And the reason it frustrates me is that any winnable game turned loss can cost you the division. It can cost you home field in the wild card round. That said, this was a series that could have been a trap. Sammy and I, we talked about it in Arizona, how weird the series could potentially be with not necessarily knowing how the pitching matchups for games 2 and 3 were going to go. We didn't know that they were going to get one of the best Red Sox starting pitcher debuts in team history from Connelly Early. And we certainly didn't know what we were going to get in game 3. We didn't know what we were going to get in game 3 until the game was happening. So yeah, this could have been a weird series, and it was nice to see the bats come out and hit early in the first two games. They hadn't gotten out to a lead to start a game in a week, and they did it in back-to-back games, and they did it in big fashion, and they got really good pitching from Crochet and early in the bullpen in those games, and it was really good to just...
I don't understand.
That's my Siri. It was good to win a series. It was good to win a series that could have gone bad, and I'm trying not to lose sight of that, but it is frustrating at the same time that there was a winnable game today, and when you're tied with the Yankees going into a day and you lose a winnable game with 2 weeks to go in a season, 2 weeks worth of games to go in a season, it hurts. It does. It's a game-by-game, day-by-day season.
Well, as you gentlemen know, I'm a man of my word. And Gordo, I'll remind you, when we got off that brutal red-eye that we took from Arizona back to Boston, we were on the walking sidewalk in the airport, whatever you want to call that thing in Logan, I said to you, I'm very nervous about this series against the A's. I will gladly take 2 out of 3. So I'm not going to complain. Today's game was frustrating. See, Chapman finally gives up some offense. I don't think you could be too mad at him for that. It was bound to happen eventually. Still been amazing. But it happens. Can't win every game. Every game is crucial. Yes, but still, they won the series. This, if you think back to game two of that Arizona series, we were like, oh my God, this team is lost without Roman Anthony. The offense is MIA. The pitching is falling apart. The energy is gone. And then they win the finale. They win the first two in Sacramento / Oakland. 3-3 road trip. Yeah, you would like for a little bit better, but this isn't the end of the world. It was a success overall. You avoided disaster, more importantly, because it felt like you were headed that way. And yeah, now you got an off day Thursday and then big series incoming.
Yeah, I mean, I think going into the road trip, six games against D-backs and A's, you would have, I think all of us would have said 4-2 bare minimum. After how that Arizona series went, I think going into the A series, I think everyone would have settled for 2-3. Gordon, like you alluded to, sucks that today was a winnable game. It was frustrating too, because like even early on, you kind of had not a hunch that they were going to lose, but there was a lot of wasted opportunity. And then they finally capitalized. They finally tie it up. And then, of course, today of all days, Chapman loses the no hit, no blown save streak. But 3-3 on the road. I'm still worried about this team with no Roman, but they didn't lay over and die. They didn't roll over and die. 2 out of 3 going into the biggest series of the year, probably. And I think that's going to stay that way unless somehow the Toronto series winds up for the division. I would say that this is the biggest series of the year. Let's go.
Also, I want to add that we all three of us said that game three against the A's was a winnable game. I would blame the loss on the early innings of the game where they left 300 different base runners on base. You had that Mason Barnett kid on the ropes, I think, three separate times. So, yeah, Chapman, whatever. In the late innings, the offense kind of disappeared, but that game was lost early on. They had plenty of opportunities. Just want to make that clear. We're not blaming this at all on whatever happened in the late innings.
Yeah, no, certainly not. So I think I've been trying to think in my head how we should order this. And I feel like what is deserved for the first conversation is the second game and what happened and what could have happened. I mean, Dustin May goes down. What is it? Neuritis in the elbow. Is that what it's called? Pat, neuritis?
Yeah.
So, okay. I guess he's got some swelling in his forearm. I don't know. I don't know if we see Dustin May again this year. He seems to think maybe, I don't know. Before we get to Connolly early, because yes, he deserves a huge portion of this podcast dedicated to him and what he was able to do. But you can't get to that without Dustin May. And it's hard to describe the Dustin May experience and the trade for Dustin May as anything other than a colossal failure for the Red Sox. I mean, at the time when they traded for him, what did we say? We said, this is a guy who's not having a very good year, that the Dodgers are down to give up on, and he has an extensive injury history. So,
gotta stop trading for guys the Dodgers don't want. Holy shit. Please, like
there were a million different avenues that this could have failed. And you saw multiple of them because he wasn't pitching well. He was a guy that they felt so, I guess, unconfident in that they had him mopping up a game to skip him in favor of a guy who is in his first professional season to help him rest and get ready for a start the following Friday. That's what they thought of Dustin May. And then, so of course, yes, he was pitching badly. Then he goes down with the injury. You're seeing it multiple ways, and they gave up James Tibbs, who, yeah, like no one gives a shit about James Tibbs right now, but like that was one of the bigger pieces of the Devers trade. As a first round pick from last year, you gave him up for a rental with all these red flags instead of trading for a number of guys that could have helped this team. And it's talked about endlessly, but sticking to Dustin May, it just, to me at the time, you could dream on the upside as people have Dustin May's entire career, but for a rental, to me, it just never made much sense. And, you know, we're at where we're at. And thank God that Connolly early stepped up and you're seeing some other guys try to fill in, but they should have opted for an option with more certainty than Dustin May if they were going with a rental, which they did.
Right. And I don't want to hear anyone saying, oh, the prices were exorbitant at the deadline. There were, what, 5-6 guys that all four of us, Joe too, we discussed as viable options, some better than others. None of us mentioned Dustin May. None of us. And we were all shocked when that trade went down because it didn't make any sense. and it's been a disaster. That's basically the end of it. I don't know what else I can add to it. I understand picking up a guy who you can, quote unquote, put in a lab, in the lab, and extract some value out of him, but that's not really something you do with only 2 months left in the season. And there were flashes. Sure, he had a couple good starts early on, but as it goes on, we're, unfortunately, it seems like we were right to be confused by this move. And yeah, that's it. I don't get it. And it didn't make sense at the time. Doesn't make sense now.
Yeah. I think the other thing too is like, they weren't really in a position at the deadline to take on a gamble like a Dustin May. Like if they were the Phillies when Wheeler was healthy, like sure. Like that's a team that could take a gamble on May. Like they have a great rotation, six starter, need some depth because they traded away McAbel. Like there's teams out there that can afford that risk. It's typically teams with a legitimate five-man or a really good four-man that can take those risks. You needed guaranteed innings and quality innings. You settled for basically what you could get at the buzzer after you did, after Joe Ryan talks fell through, to be honest. And Sammy, you said it, but there were there was a list of a good five or six guys that we were like, it's not Joe Ryan and it's not, you know, Mackenzie Gore, but they're serviceable. Like Charlie Mort was on that list. Merrill Kelly was on that list. Like there were plenty of guys who they realistically could have gotten. And they kind of shot themselves in the foot getting tied up in Joe Ryan trades, trade talks that ultimately go nowhere. The Dustin May experience as a whole, aside from that one weird outing where he just completely dominated the Astros.
Good. He was so good. Yeah. That day. He was so good.
Yeah. Aside from that one outing, probably just as good as Walker Buehler. And
yeah,
it's frustrating to look back on. But Gordo, you said it too. It's luckily you have the pitching depth that you've been basically singing your praises about. And guys are starting to step up. I mean, Connelly Early, we'll get to it, but tip of the cap, Connelly Early. Harrison came up. Tolley's come up. Like you had options, but you really wanted certainty at the deadline.
You brought up a really interesting point. The Dustin May to Walker Buehler comp. Let's dig into that. You've got guys coming off long-term injuries, pitching poorly for the Dodgers that they do not want anymore. They didn't give a qualifying offer to Walker Buehler, which is basically what he signed for with the Red Sox. They were willing to trade Dustin May because they didn't want him in their rotation. They wanted all the other guys in their rotation. And the Red Sox wanted both of them, and both of them were not good for the Red Sox. Like it is so similar. The only difference, though, is that with Buehler, you at least had an offseason and a spring training to work with him to try to unlock something. With Dustin May, you didn't even have that.
And a much longer track record. Yeah. Go ahead.
If you had a year and a half with Dustin May, I would be sitting here saying the exact same thing as I'm saying with Jordan Hicks. Yes, it sucks, but how are you going to overhaul a guy in season? It's the same thing we've been saying with Kyle Harrison. Like, it's a work in progress, and the offseason is where the real work is done with these types of guys that you get in your organization midseason. Dustin May was a rental. He was a rental. It was never possible.
You can't put a rental in the lab effectively. That was so frustrating. It was like, dude, put him in the lab. Dude, you know what this is like with Buehler and May? It's like that South Park episode where they're deciding between douche and turd.
I vaguely There's remember no that, good but I don't know.
They're running for election. One candidate is douche, the other one is turd, and you got to pick one. And then, I was going to say no offense to Buehler and May, but that was just objectively offensive. So, yeah, it's just two terrible offensive options.
Realistically, off the top of your head, can you name the last time the Dodgers lost either letting a player go or lost a trade?
Jordan Alvarez.
But that was for...
There you go.
Okay. Okay,
that's for Josh Fields. That may not be the last time. 2016-ish.
They traded O'Neill Cruz for what was it, like Jason Grilly or something?
But that's a good point, yeah. Pat. That's still a good point. That was years ago. That was a long time ago at this point. Jordan's become like a historic player with the Astros in that time.
I could not tell you who the Dodgers got for Gavin Lux. They won that trade. I can tell you that right now. They won that trade. They did.
It's like the Patriots with Belichick in their prime, when they were in the AFC Championship every year. Nobody should be trading with them because they're so much smarter than every other team, and they're going to win the trade.
Joe?
They did lose a trade. They lost the Mookie Betts trade because they gave up Connor Wong, and Connor Wong unlocked Garrett Crochet and unlocked Aroldis Chapman.
Oh, I don't buy into that.
Joe is 100% right. Our backup catcher is way better than the perennial MVP candidate.
The Connor Wong Chapman stuff, it has gotten crazy. Even the Narv was like giving him credit on foul territory. I couldn't believe it.
There's no way it's true. There's no How way. Could it possibly be true? No chance. I hope it's true, but there's no way.
There's no way. But let's get to Connolly early. It's been enough. We're 14 minutes into this podcast. We've been beating around the bush. Holy shit. Holy shit.
What describes it.
I saw the notification that he was coming up to pitch, and it's like, okay, he's coming off a really good outing. He had 10 strikeouts in his last AAA outing, but even though he had a 2.6 ERA in the minor leagues this year, the velocity had increased. Really the only concerns people lay out there about the guy is that, he loses velocity late in outings, and that's pretty much been it. Yet, with that being it, he's still not on top 100 lists, despite his season. All the other guys the Red Sox have had this year that have had success, like Brandon Clarke, they couldn't have put on the lists faster. But with Connolly early, for whatever reason, it didn't happen. So he just didn't get the same level of hype that some of these other guys, like certainly Peyton Tolley, shot up the lists. So he got tons of hype, and it was deserved. Early, it was the last second thing, at least in terms of like when the fans heard about it, comes up, makes the start. You can't say enough about what he did. 5 innings, 5 hits, no runs, 1 walk, 11 strikeouts, tied in a Red Sox record for most strikeouts in a major league debut for a Red Sox player. He had 19 whiffs. Like, Peyton Tolley dominated that first outing. Like, we were gushing over what Peyton Tolley did in that first outing. He had 14 whiffs in that outing. Connolly Early had 19 in this. And Connolly Early is not the prospect that Peyton Tolley is. But for him to go out there and top what Peyton Tolley did is in his debut is borderline unfathomable. Because we went on radio that next day, and for 3 hours, the three of us and Rob gushed about Peyton Tolley, and 12 days later, Early does this. I mean, it was just amazing.
Yeah, so I think the reason, and people might be listening, like, why were you guys not hyping up Connolly Early the same way you were Peyton Tolley? The reason is Tolley was drafted a year ago and flew from single A to the big leagues in less than a full season. Connolly Early was drafted in 2023. Not to say he's not a good prospect. He is. And what I like about him is he seems like a high floor guy. He's someone who you could see being a major league pitcher, whether he's a number 3 starter, a number 4, number 5. That's probably what he's going to profile as. Most scouting reports have him as a back end guy. The interesting thing for me, why this start was so kind of not satisfying is not the right word, but here's the thing. Merrill Kelly is the rental that all three of us said this is the number one rental. If you can get a rental pitcher, this is the guy you want. He's a veteran, he's having a good season, and he's playoff proven. Like, check, check, check. Connolly Early was who the Diamondbacks wanted for him, allegedly, and the Red Sox said no. So now you fast forward to yesterday, Connolly Early absolutely deals, and the Red Sox front office looked like geniuses. Because before the game, I posted that, and people were like, you would have been so much better off with Merrill Kelly if you had him in house. And maybe those people are right, but that has to make you feel a lot better about not moving Connolly Early. You could separate the two things. Two things can be true. Yes, the Red Sox would be better off with Merrill Kelly, but also Connolly Early, a very good kind of, I guess you could say, safe prospect. For the Red Sox, a guy that you can feel good about putting him in a starting spot in the big leagues as soon as right now.
Yeah, I think the one thing I really appreciate about Connolly is he reminds me a lot of like Hunter Dobbins. He's not some, top 100 prospect. He has legit credibility in the prospect world, but he's not like a fast riser like a Tolley. He doesn't have the arm of a Brandon Clarke. Like, the one thing that I truly like, though, is his repertoire is so polished. Mm-hmm. He threw every pitch well. He was locating every pitch. He's not going to blow you away with the fastball. I think he got up to 96, maybe 2 or 3 times yesterday, but normally he was sitting 94-ish. The curve played. The sweeper was great. His kick change is very good. The kick change was great. And that's all you could ever want as an organization. Like, sure, you're going to get what we hope, the Peyton Tolleys are, these guys who could be, the 1B, the 2A, the 1B, the 2s, like the higher level guys. But if you can consistently turn out 3, 4, 5s, you're helping yourself in the long term because you have cost control back in pitching that can be reliable, blah, 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 blah. These are also the types of players who get a little bit more, like a little bit boosted trade value. I'm not saying trade Carly early, obviously. I'm just saying we're seeing an ability for the Red Sox to manufacture back end and mid tier pitching. Every team in the league is always going to want that. You set yourself up to be like the Dodgers, where you have these arms to deal from. You have these options. Years before, I mean, we're talking about Kyle Barraclough starting games. Like, you now have multiple guys who are like fringe top 100, top 150 guys who are coming up and making a meaningful impact. Carly Early of the bunch had by far the best debut. But it's encouraging as an organization to now be able to see this be a pipeline.
And you talk about encouraging. Connelly Early has, I think he's the sixth best pitching prospect, fifth or sixth. You have Tolley, Perales, Witherspoon,
Clark,
Lara, and Clark ranked ahead of him. So that's, I mean, that was your sixth highest ranked pitching prospect. You got to feel good about that. That's something we've never experienced in our lifetime. I don't think any Red Sox fan has ever experienced the Red Sox
You could go to like the Henry Owens and all those guys, and like none of them worked. Like they were all prospects. Like there was like three to five of those guys that were around the top 100.
But this wasn't as deep. Like these guys.
I think there was like
seeing the development too.
I think there's like a 6-year stretch where the Sox top pitching prospect was either Brian Johnson or Henry Owens.
Right. Like it didn't work, but like at the time, I think it was Sammy. Sammy, you talked about the front office not trading Connelly Early for the rental Merrill Kelly. It is a victory for the front office, but really like it's also a huge victory in a line of many victories this year and probably many more to come in the coming years, but it's a huge victory for the pitching development program. Like this is a guy who drafted in 2023, fifth round pick, throwing 89 to 91 on his fastball. Mm-hmm. And they talked about it on the broadcast. Like he learned, like Pat, you talked about his well-rounded repertoire. Like he learned to throw his best pitch is his changeup, and he's throwing the changeup, the curveball. It was like a kind of a hardish slider too. And mm-hmm. all of these things he developed because he didn't have velocity to work with. It's like with all these other pitchers historically with baseball, it's let's target the velocity and teach them the pitch. This guy, he knew how to pitch, but the Red Sox have this unique newfound ability to teach guys velocity. You see it with Peyton Tolley this year. You're seeing it with Connelly Early this year. And you found a guy who knew how to pitch, and you added 3, 4, 5 miles an hour to his fastball. It changes the dynamic of what that guy can offer. And you saw it in this start. Like the fastball played because of everything else. It's like he's the anti-Tolley. They're complete opposites. And
he's a low floor guy. It's nice to have those guys. It's super to have that in your back pocket is great.
Yeah. I mean, I'd argue they're both pretty low floor guys because one of them, he's got like a bunch of pitches that work, and the other one's got this one elite pitch that's going to guarantee in some capacity that he's a successful big leaguer. Pat?
High floor.
Yeah. Sorry. Did I say low floor?
High floor. You both said high floor. You guys are high. You guys like these guys. I'm just
kidding. I don't hate them. They like Connelly Early was not bad in game two. He was good.
Did I say low floor?
You both did. You said low floor, and then Gordo echoed it.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, 2-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
You feeling the effects from that red eye. Listen, okay, we had the red eye, right, the other day, and then we had one day where it was like normal rest, and then last night there was the game, and it went till like 1, and then I had to wake up at 6:45 because I had some guy banging on my door to install the blinds. Couldn't go back to sleep because I had to do the Nesson thing in the morning. So I'm running on nothing. So yeah, they have low floors.
The only thing I'd add to what you said, Gordo, is I think it's a victory for pitching development, getting Connelly Early to where he's at now. I'm not ready to call it a victory for the front office hanging on to him, because if we get to October and the Red Sox are in a playoff spot and you have a big game and it's that number 4 spot and you're thinking, shit, could have had Merrill Kelly, who, by the way, has a 2.98 ERA and 7 starts over 42.1 innings since the trade. He's been good. So I'm not to take anything away from Connolly early. I'm just like, I'm not ready to celebrate not making that move yet.
Okay. Now here's a question for you then. And this is a good one because it's going to be tough. What's today's date? We're recording on September 10th. If the trade deadline was right, was tonight, midnight tonight, and the Diamondbacks still had Merrill Kelly, and they said, we will give you Merrill Kelly for Connolly Early straight up. That's the only offer on the table right now. Would you make that trade?
Well, I don't think the Diamondbacks would do it straight up. But if they did, I would say yes. And it's nothing against Connolly Early. It's like I said, you got multiple guys ranked ahead of him in the organization. You have the luxury of being able to take a poor value trade to help you in the immediate, especially you look at how weak the American League is. Oh my God, it's wide open. Even without Roman Anthony, it is wide the fuck open. So again, I really like Connolly Early. I think he's going to be very good. But I also think this Red Sox team could make a run in the playoffs. And once you're in and you're on a roll, who knows? I'm thinking banners.
Pat, would you make that trade?
I would. And the reason I say I would is for the reason I just mentioned. They're now proving that they truly can develop a pitching pipeline. I think Connolly Early is going to be a rotational piece for years to come. I think he's a good prospect. Like I was just raving about his repertoire. I think he has the stuff to be a legit major league pitcher. That being said, you've now, I hate calling it the lab, but I'll call it the pipeline. I like the pipeline much better. You've established this kind of pipeline where you're getting, now I wouldn't even call them like project pieces, just high upside guys, and you're actually developing them. Like Connolly Early was what, a fifth round pick out of Virginia, something like that.
Yep.
He had decent stuff. I'm sure when he was drafted, they said, you know, reliever upside kind of thing. They build up fastball velo. Because, I mean, even Tolley came out of TCU sitting 92-93. He's up to 98 at points. Like, they're maximizing the fastball. They're establishing the secondary pitches. They're able to actually build starting pitchers. And I'm not calling Connolly Early, you know, not valuable, whatever. But they just have this knack now to develop these kinds of guys. He is expandable, just like Password's expandable in the outfield. I'm not calling Password a bad outfielder. It's now, incredibly enough, becoming a position of depth. You have to be able to move on from these guys to improve yourself in areas that you don't have depth.
It's a compliment, too. It's a compliment to Connolly Early. We're saying, like, absolutely. This guy's so good, he could have gotten you the best rental pitcher on the market. So, again, I hate when people are like, you don't like Connolly Early. I'm like, no, I think he's awesome. I just want this team to win now, and I already think they're set up for the future. That's why I'm saying I'd do it. Gordo, would you?
You guys tempt me, because when I asked the question, I was thinking certainly I wouldn't do it. And I know it's huge recency bias, because if you'd asked me this 36 hours ago, I would have done it. But to me, when you've got a guy with as much helium as he's had and he comes up and he does what he did in his debut, those guys are not traded for rentals. Those guys are reserved for controllable pieces. I'm not saying don't trade the guy, but like we talk about, how can this team get a Joe Ryan in the offseason without trading a Peyton Tolley? When you've got multiple guys, and this is not me saying to trade them necessarily, but when you've got guys like Connolly Early, when you've got guys like Hunter Dobbins, when you've got guys like Richard Fitz, who has shown, people forget what he showed earlier this year when he was actually healthy. Like when you've got guys like that, that can fit into a rotation and be a legitimate, not just controllable big league starter, but a controllable big league starter for 5-6 years. Those guys carry significant weight on the trade market. When you package those guys with a blue chip, that's how you get a stud starting pitcher without including your best guy, Peyton Tolley. So to me, I don't want to waste those guys on rentals. I know like their pitching is not, they do not have right now in this moment, a guy that you trust as a fourth starter for the postseason. But yeah, when I see a guy doing what he did, those guys do not go for rentals to me.
So here's who's ahead. I briefly went over it. You have Peyton Tolley, who's your number one prospect. Then you have 3 and 4 is Perales and Witherspoon. Then you have Clark is your 6th-ranked prospect. Valera is your 7th-ranked prospect. Connolly Early is your 8th-ranked prospect, but he is your 5th-ranked pitcher. And then right behind him, you have David Sandlin on top of Brian Bello and Garrett Crochet, who are both in their mid-20s locked up. So,
oh, yeah. Not saying you need them. Not saying you need to keep them.
So would you have done it before? Did that one start change your mind?
The one start changed my mind. Because
Same.
When you've got a guy with as much helium as he has, and he proves what he proved, which is that he can not just pitch in the big leagues, but dominate a big league lineup. I get it. It's one start. To me, those guys don't go for rentals. That's just a philosophy thing. There are teams that do it. There are teams that trade things that I think are way too good to be giving for rentals, but it's just not, I wouldn't do it.
So then I want to ask you guys what I put out on the Twitter poll on Sox Booth on Twitter. After their first start, who were you more excited about? Were you more excited about Toley and what he did against the Pirates, or what Early did this past week?
Early start was better, but I was definitely more excited about Toley.
Yeah, Toley's. If you just watch Toley, he gives you that, like, holy shit, like, this guy could be an ace kind of vibe.
He also comes with the pedigree, too. It's like when you have a legitimate top prospect that comes up and dominates, like, part of you thinks, oh my God, that is just going to continue like that. Whereas with Early, like, he is a good prospect, but I'm not sitting here thinking he's about to go five shut with double digit Ks again next start. He hadn't struck out 11 guys in his professional career or his collegiate career.
Yeah, I think I agree. I would say Toley. Early was definitely, I don't even know what word to describe it, but I guess more encouraging. Early's was more encouraging. Toley's, though, like, Toley is everything you want in, like, a top pitching prospect. He's built like a moose. He's got the look, the charisma, the stuff. I was definitely more excited, and still am more excited about Toley, but Early's debut was nothing short of incredibly encouraging.
And just for the record, Gordo, you do have someone on your side, because I said I didn't want to trade Early either. So
you were way ahead of the game, Joe.
I was way ahead of the curve.
Was that the Edward discussion?
Yeah.
You didn't have Early in there? Because you did talk about that at one point. It was in the Edward thing.
I said, I don't feel comfortable giving up Connolly Early.
Okay, let's move on to Toley, though, because we were just talking Toley. I want to get there, because now we're back-to-back less than encouraging starts. I mean, I don't know. Today's start was weird because he faced the lineup one time. He went two innings, but it's back-to-back outings where it's pretty clear that, and it's nothing new. If you have one pitch in the big leagues, unless you have like Mason Miller's fastball, you're going to get hit with it. And right now, I'm not saying you can't do it by the end of the year, but I don't know. His secondaries right now are not in a place where he's going to be a go-to starter, particularly in a playoff rotation. I just haven't seen it with any of the secondaries yet. He's got an elite fastball. You're going to dream on what he's going to be in the future when you've got that fastball, and like, his secondaries have come a long way this year. So you still feel good. You still feel great about what he's going to be long-term. But for this year, I do have a lot of reservations about what I think he can be and what role he should be in, because it's pretty clear that in a three, four, five, anything close to a starting pitcher role, it feels like teams are just going to sit on that one pitch, and once they see it enough times, they're going to get it.
Yeah, I don't feel supremely confident with him out there. First start was great, of course, but now he's pitching on less days rest than he's used to. Luckily, the Red Sox have some off days coming up, so likely they can get Peyton Toley on his normal rest, which is not normal Major League Baseball rest, but I think it's totally fine to, you know.
But they got that for the second start. He was on.
Yeah. But then you have one good one, one bad one, and then you have this weird A's one. So, you know, like I said, not supremely confident with him out there, but the stuff is so electric. It's not beyond, like, it's not crazy to think he could turn it on at any point. He just needs to be able to land one of his secondaries consistently, because right now it's the fastball, and if the fastball isn't perfect, then he's kind of a sitting duck. And that's what we saw in Arizona. Like we said on the last episode, overcorrected a little bit. It seemed like he went too much to his breaking stuff, and then he lost the command of the fastball and just spiraled from there. And then today looked like he had the fastball command going again, but then gives up the home run early, bangaliers, whatever, it happens. Then the next inning, he gives one up to Kurtz, and my first thought was, crap, that works in the minor leagues. That pitch works, but it's right down the middle. You just have to, like, he's a work in progress. I don't want people to be too hard on this kid, just like I don't want people to get too high on Connolly early, because he's not going to strike out 11 every time, and Peyton Toley's not going to get rocked every time, and he's not going to be a stud every time. These are kids. They're learning on the fly, and for both of them, I would say this is why you need veterans in tow because you know what you're getting. Both these guys are wild cards. We don't feel great about Toley in his next outing, and we probably feel really good about Connolly early in his next outing. And it wouldn't be crazy if those two flipped, and we're talking about the exact opposite next time we record. So, yeah, and I'm not really sure what the move is to do with Toley. I think I'm still at where I was last episode, where I said give him 3-4 innings, give him an attainable task, and let him thrive in that role.
Yeah, I think the big thing with Toley is that Pittsburgh game, the adrenaline's going. His fastball is up more than it's really ever been. He was sitting for the first, I think it was 2, maybe 3 innings. He was comfortably sitting like 95 to 98. So what's already an electric fastball plays up even more so. The secondaries in that initial game were good. His secondaries in the Pittsburgh game were good. And it was weird because he wasn't necessarily pitching guys backward, but he would start fastball, go to secondary, and then his strikeout pitch was he would go back to the fastball and locate it. The thing that we've been seeing in Arizona and now Sacramento is he tries to get ahead or tries to establish the secondary pitches, and he just can't right now. He can't. The cutter was okay-ish today. The fastball, whatever, like the curve, the sweeper, all that, like, he can't locate. And when he tries to establish it, he gets behind. Once he gets behind, the only thing he can locate is that fastball. And once teams know that you can hunt fastball on a guy, you're fucked. You're fucked. You are.
Yeah. You are.
Anyone.
Yeah. The thing here, when Sammy and I were talking in the seats in Arizona on the last pod, one thing that I said was, you're relying on one of Dustin May and Kyle Harrison to be a standalone starter, and then you would connect Toley to the other one. Because Toley, innings-wise, A, he's in his first full season and probably should not be increasing his workload at this point in the season. And B, right now with the status of his secondaries, it probably wouldn't work to ask him to be like a 5-plus inning guy. So I still stand there. Really, the only thing that's changed is Dustin May's not there, but now in steps Connolly early. But right now you're in this weird spot where you have to eat. What do they have, like 14 games left? What is it?
Trying to do math.
I think they 16.
They are roughly 81 15. And 66, whatever. Yeah, roughly 15. I'm not doing math. I forget. We had a weird math mishap before the show. Oh, we were trying to figure out the season series with the Sox Yankees. And Pat,
we also
simple math.
Yeah, but we also said the wrong episode number last episode. We're bad at math. This is not a math pod.
Joe, we were trying to figure out the episode number, so I went into the email, and I went and I saw the last episode link that Joe emailed to us without realizing that we had recorded a Justin Slayton one without a link since then. So, yeah, screwed that up.
Well, whatever. Just going behind the curtain, Gordo never knows what episode number it is.
That's true.
He's always looking in the subject line of our recording, and he never knows.
It's 262. I know it off the dome. But
you're not going to remember it by your outro.
I'm going to remember it. Trust me, Joe. If you can change the subject line right now, get rid of it, and I'll remember it. I don't know if you can do that, but if you can, do it.
I'd rather not take that chance.
I'll remember it. You can trust me. You can trust me. I'm running on no sleep. You can still trust me. But whatever I was trying to get to here was that you're relying on three guys in Peyton Toley, Connolly Early, and Kyle Harrison, who we haven't yet talked about but will before the end of this episode, to fill two rotation days for probably three turns through the rotation. If you want to, you can utilize the off days and shorten the rotation. But if you saw the way your best three dudes performed with that short rest last time, maybe not the best idea to do that. So you do have to kind of figure out what you want to do with those two spots. And I honestly think, I don't even know. I don't know. I would piggyback Toley with someone. And honestly, I'd probably do what they did today, this series. Connolly Early gets his standalone start till he proves that teams can hit him. And you go with Harrison connected to Toley. The only thing I would change is I would start Harrison and have Toley be the high octane piggyback off of him.
Yeah, I think today, as we record, starting Toley was the right move. But in the future, I'm with you, Gordo. I'd let Harrison start, who, by the way, looked really good. Very impressed by Kyle Harrison. And then Toley, you could just tell him, dude, look, you could even, I said 3-4 innings earlier, you could shorten that out of the pen. Give us one or two good innings. If you're still cooking, stay out there. But yeah, one or two, and just fucking blow guys away with that fastball. You can do that in short spurts. I imagine he'll be throwing like 99, 98, 99 consistently if he's coming out the pen. So, but yeah, this whole conversation, and I hate to beat a dead horse, but it's just, oh, why did you not get someone more reliable than Dustin May? This whole conversation would be
moot. It all connects. Everything's connected from start.
And then
start
we'd be talking
finish.
about who do you use out of the bullpen in the playoffs? You've got Early, Harrison, Tolley, any of these guys who come out of the bullpen, and now you have an extra weapon, but we're talking about them as starters. And none of those three guys I would feel great about starting a playoff game. They're rookies. They're kids. And you want them to start, you're probably going to play the Yankees, most likely, and you're going to have a kid start one of those games, and maybe on the road in Yankee Stadium, like, sheesh, man, not a great place to be. And, you know,
they're 22, whatever. 23, and 24 years old.
Kids, dude, kids.
Granted, Roman's 21, and the dude just took over Yankee Stadium. Well, he's a different breed.
He's a freak. Yeah, he's a freak.
He is a freak.
A little different when you're a bat, too. Go ahead, bat.
Game four. Who are you guys starting right now?
I don't know. Whoever's the hot hand. Seriously. You cannot, in my opinion, you cannot answer that question right now. You can't.
You can't.
Right now, if game four were tomorrow, it's Connelly Early because he's the hot hand.
So, and one thing, too, that is worth mentioning is Connelly Early's been getting normal pitch limits in for starters.
What do you mean by that? Are you like saying his pitch count's been normal?
Pitch count has been normal in terms of like he's throwing 80, 90 pitches.
Right. And where Tolley in the minors was at like 65 to 70.
Extended rest, 70 pitches. Like Early's the best suited right now to actually take over a rotation spot. And then, you know,
but
have
he's
Harrison
been extended
and Tolley
rest
piggyback.
Too. They've all been like Harrison,
they have
too,
been.
All of them. Harrison has experience on normal rest, but with the Red Sox, all three of those guys in AAA.
Yeah.
Once a week.
Early's been on the most normal schedule, you could say, because Tolley's been, his has been up and down kind of weird lately. Harrison's been dealing with the ankle injury, so he hasn't pitched a ton lately. Early's been the most, still not perfectly consistent usage-wise, but the most consistent. Yeah. He's also been in the organization the longest, which I think means something. Harrison's been a pro the longest, but Early's been in the organization the longest, and then Tolley is.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, two-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know who. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.
Is like a newly hatched egg, so
it's impossible to know. It really is.
Yeah, it's the hot
because
hand. Gordo,
the calculus
you
changes
it.
every turn through the rotation. The calculus is going to change because if Connelly Early lets up six runs next start, we're not going to give a shit that he's on the most normal pitch count. He's going to have given up six runs.
Right. Yeah, it's the hot hand. That's the way you got to do it. Which is not a great place to be, but
it's
you know,
where
like
they are.
You said,
I mean, you could bullpen it. That's the fourth option. You could straight up bullpen it.
But that could torch you completely. Risky.
That's basically what they did today. Like, if they'd kept the lead, like they were up 3-2 and then they went down 4-3, if they'd kept the 3-2 lead, would they have just not gone to Harrison and just bullpen it the rest of the way? Because I honestly think that, well, depends. We don't know. Whitlock didn't go in the series at all, right? No, he didn't. And there's last no time we saw him, he was limping off the mound in Arizona. But if he was available, like, I honestly think they probably wouldn't have even gone to Harrison.
No way to know. They might not have. Yeah. I could see that. Totally, totally realistic.
But they did go to him, and let's fit in some Kyle Harrison talk before he gets enough said. It's been a weird experience for him since getting to the Red Sox, just because like this is a guy who has multiple years pitching in the majors, and he was basically a full-time major leaguer last year, was a major leaguer for a lot of this year, even though weirdly he started his season in Sacramento. So he was pitching at the ballpark that he called home briefly at the start of the year, which is really weird because it's a big league game, but whatever. Gets to Boston in the Devers trade. They overhaul his arsenal. They teach him a cutter. They teach him a sinker. They change his changeup grip. And so now three of the five pitches that he's throwing are new pitches. He's trying to learn how to throw his four-seam fastball as effectively as he did before with these new pitches, which I can't explain why, but apparently it's a process to like learn how to throw all these pitches together and make the fastball as effective as it was with his old repertoire. The numbers in AAA were, I mean, his effectiveness was up and down. I mean, the command was hit or miss, but he was keeping runs off the board. He would have occasional outings where the strikeouts were there. Other times he'd have, you know, trouble putting guys away, but it's the same thing that we say about Peyton Tolley, where it's like in the minors, they're trying to teach Peyton Tolley to throw his secondaries. So he's throwing his secondaries a ton, and maybe it's making the numbers look worse than they would be if he were throwing the fastball as often as he has been in the majors, and he could just blow the shit out of guys. Taking that one back.
Whoa.
Jesus.
Whoa.
That was the quickest redaction I've ever seen.
Taking it back. Blow him away. Taking it back. But yeah, I think you saw today that Kyle Harrison at his core, like he today was basically fastball slurve, and he mixes the cutter in as kind of a show me, maybe weak contact, maybe a get me over for a strike pitch. And it was effective. I mean, it wasn't like he was like three innings, five Ks, whatever, but he was in control of almost every at bat he was pitching and had basically no threat. And, you know, it was only two strikeouts, but he kept runs off the board and was effective. It was only three innings, but he was effective. And he was not blowing the shit out of guys.
Sorry, I'm still recovering.
Fuck you
from
guys.
That. Oh my God, dude.
I'm like looking at your faces and I'm like, I'm gonna finish this take without laughing. And I'm like, I'm focusing so hard on not laughing that I can't land the plane.
I mean, I was done laughing until I saw Pat like covering his mouth like he was about to puke. But anyway,
I can't look at Pat like that and not laugh. Every time he makes
Harrison,
that fucking face.
Thing that worried me with Harrison, the stuff that plagued him in the minors, a lot of people talk about the walks, and he did have some walk issues, but it was more so long at bats where he couldn't put guys away and he'd be facing the same batter forever and it felt like it never ended. I watched, I think, four or five of his starts in AAA, and you saw it over and over and over, and it wasn't the best batters either. It was guys who were kind of like journeyman minor leaguers and he couldn't put them away. And you didn't see either of those issues today. He was putting guys away. He was pitching to contact, which was nice. He still got his whiffs and everything. But yeah, he looked polished. I was a little bit pleasantly surprised. That's not how he looked all the time in AAA. He did have his good starts where he looked dominant like he did today. But for the most part, it was a lot of long outings with limited damage, but long outings where you're thinking this won't translate to the big leagues. I thought he looked great today. I was super impressed.
But with what you're watching in AAA, how much of that is because of he's working on new pitches in his arsenal and like he's emphasizing those pitches to try to figure out how can I beat batters with these pitches? Where if you're in a big league game, it's like, okay, I can actually just throw my really, really good fastball and get this guy out right now.
It's impossible to tell. You would have to know the game plan going into the game because some days could be like that. Like Peyton Tolley in AA specifically had starts where he threw like 50% breaking balls. You're
exactly.
Like, where'd the fastball go? And then after the game, it comes out, well, they wanted him to throw those pitches because he's working on them. He's never thrown them before. So it's impossible to tell, but
how
he did
he
stick
it
with
without throwing
he's,
it.
Right. So he stuck with his best stuff. And that's why it's so impossible to analyze guys in minor league baseball. And people just take a cursory look at the stat line, like Vaughn Grissom, great example. Oh, he's hitting 320 in AAA and he's doing this, this, and that. But like, you dig deep into it. He's not hitting velocity. He's hitting a lot of balls on the ground. There's a lot of weak contact hits. That's not going to translate. Some Bobby Dalbec. Look at all those home runs in AAA. Yes, well, also look at all those strikeouts. It's not going to translate. So put a bow on it, Kyle Harrison. He looked like that former top pitching prospect today. And I'm looking forward to the next start. The next outing, I would give him a start.
Yeah, after seeing him today, and I really haven't watched much of him aside from, you know, the Twitter highlights and his time with the Giants, but he's got a really unique windup in a really unique arm slot. I think Lou said it today on the broadcast. He carries like a 27 degree arm slot. So he's not full blown sidewinder like a Taylor Rogers, but he's not super over the top. He kind of comes from a little bit more than a three quarter slot. And when that sweeper's on from that spot, it looked really good today. Like, that's coming from so far out wide, and it's getting some legit bite to it. It's starting, like, a third in on the other side, on the left-handed batter's box, and coming in almost back foot. And then he's really quick out of the set. Did anyone else, like, notice that today? Like, he comes set.
Gets it and goes.
Immediately drop and drive. Gets set. hand up, knee up, gone. Like, there's no, and it's not a bad thing, but there's no, I don't even want to say cadence. Like, it's just a controlled chaos in a way. He just comes set, it's up and gone. It's up and gone. It's up and gone. But no, Sammy, I agree. I was encouraged by it today. I thought now that he can actually, you know, throw a normal pitch mix, kind of how you know would in a normal game. You don't have to mix in, you know, the cutter he's learning and the off speed. I thought he looked great, and I'm looking forward to seeing him again.
And here's the thing. Like, the reason the cutter is such an important pitch for him, it's supposed to increase the effectiveness of all of his other pitches. And maybe you didn't see it as much in terms of the whiffs today, but you did definitely see it in terms of the called strikes. Like, 5 called strikes on the slurve, 6 called strikes on the fastball. You saw it with one of his strikeouts. It was like, looks like it's a fastball down the middle, but when you've got that extra little wrinkle, it really does change the approach of a hitter, especially to a lefty. He's a lefty. So especially to a righty, because you think it's going to be that cutter and it's going to come in on your hands, but actually it's a fastball and it dots over the plate and it's gone by you before you know it. And you saw it a couple of times. You saw it on the called third strike.
It's to lefties and righties. He's good at tunneling, or he was today, I should say. He tunneled very well. And if you're not familiar with tunneling and you're listening, like, what the hell is tunneling? It's when a pitch looks the same. A fastball looks the same as the cutter for, you know, as long as it can before the pitch moves. And that's how you confuse hitters and throw off timing, is tunneling. So yeah, he did a good job with that today. I like the drop and drive. Kind of reminds me of, like, if Tom Seaver were left-handed and had a lower arm slot, the way Harrison's back leg is almost parallel to the ground. It's really cool, man. I'm, you know, the Devers trade was a nightmare for all of us, but this was maybe the bright spot of it. This kid looked good.
Yeah. So it'll be interesting, because you'll know by the Yankee series sort of what their plan-ish is going forward. Because, yeah, if you're going to have 6 starters, you're going to be a reliever down, which a reliever down is the same as it is. Like, you'd have the same amount of relievers you did April through August, because they added the roster spot. But if they don't option a guy, it means that they're planning to use these 3 dudes in a few days when their turn comes back. What?
I forgot the most important thing.
Uh-oh.
How do you not give Kyle Harrison number 11 after he was wearing it in AAA? That would be
comedy.
Such a funny story. Give him the same number as Rafael Devers. Move on quickly, and this is the guy you got from. They gave him Curt Schilling coded number 38. Disappointing.
Yeah, I definitely thought he was taking 11. That would have been great.
At least Connolly Early got Phillips Valdez's old number.
Oh, shout out Phillips Valdez. Also, 70 plays for Early. I don't know why.
71.
He looks like 71. Looks like a big number guy. I don't know why. In the same way it plays for Hauk. I don't know. Makes no sense to me, because usually high numbers, I don't know.
89, dude? Oh, I don't like that.
89's a weird number, but Hauk, a high number works for Hauk. Like, Hauk doesn't feel like a 28 or a 29. Like, no, he's got to be 50 or above.
All right, that's fair.
All right, let's get to Nuff Said. Lastly, before Nuff Said, shout out Garrett Crochet for bouncing back. We can't not mention that he just bounced back and dominated after concerning is the wrong word, but 2 starts that were not necessarily up to his par. So there we go. It's mentioned. Anyone got enough said?
I already warned you guys that I had one coming.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. You did.
All right. So the reason I told you guys is this is a tough question. I'm trying to pull up the prompt. Okay. So my question is, which of these 5 dominant Red Sox closers has the best entrance? And I'm going to list them off one by one, and then I want you guys to power rank them. Joe, feel free to jump in as well if you'd like. Folk, Keith Folk, who walked out to Mother by Danzig. Jonathan Papelbon walks out to Shipping Up to Boston, Dropkick Murphys. Craig Kimbrell, Welcome to the Jungle. Koji, Sandstorm. And Aroldis Chapman with Carnival. Give me your rankings, 5 to 1, 5 being the least exciting, 1 being the most exciting.
Okay, I can go first on this. 5, I'm giving it to Keith Folk just because I do not remember ever being in person when he came into a game. So maybe I was, I don't know, maybe I just don't remember it, but yeah, 5 by default. 4, I'm going Aroldis. 3, I'm going Koji. 2, I'll go Craig Kimbrell. I really like the flame entrance. I thought that was really cool.
Yes.
And by an absolute fucking landslide, not even remotely close, not even in the same stratosphere, it's in a class of its own. Papelbon, number one, easy.
Okay. Okay.
I thought we were going to have the same exact order. We don't.
Let's hear where we differ.
Folk is five for me. Same thing. I was 5 years old, 2004. I remember, you know, World Series game. I don't remember his walkout like at all. Four for me is Aroldis. Carnival does like nothing for me. I love the Louis T.
What?
I love the Louis T on the homage to Louis. The song itself just it's too mellow. I need something to get the blood going.
I agree.
Three for me is Kimbrel. The Flame, Welcome to the Jungle, him trotting out, like the Flame matched the beard. Like it was good. Kimbrel's was great. Koji's is honest to God the most underrated closer walkout. Like there's the tier of, you know, Mo, Heath Bell, Papelbon. Like there's that tier of like guys who was just like, oh, this is perfect. Koji's right there, dude. Sandstorm. I either want my closer to have all of the personality, a la Jonathan Papelbon, or just like Stone Cold Killer, no emotion. And Koji. Koji would do that like soccer mom jog out of the bullpen, straight face, get on the mound, and then just make people look like an idiot. Sandstorm, Koji's demeanor, all that. Awesome. Number one's Papelbon. Like Papelbon had the energy, he had the build, the emotion. The song was phenomenal. It was like peak, like Red Sox. I'm not going to call it dynasty, but like popularity back then. Everything about Papelbon coming out of the pen to ship it up to Boston was just like S tier. It was so good. He did.
Like he was it. He was
perfectly.
It.
Perfectly.
Yeah, I hate to sort of factor in presentation on my rankings, but that's sort of where I go with it.
You sure?
I go folk five. I go Chapman four, obviously. Three, 1, 2, 3 is really, really tough for me. Like I think I would probably just do Koji because it's so
Koji where
I'm not. I would go three for Koji.
Okay,
just because I'm not gonna say like it's a bad song or a bad entrance, but I just feel like it's kind of it was before where they like installed the lights and how had all that graphic. Kimbrel, on the other hand, like. You mentioned it earlier. He had like the flame throwing and you knew that he could throw 100 and he had the funky windup or whatever. So that's why I do Koji 3, I do Kimbrel 2, and then Papelbon clearing away number one.
Joey, right. Pound for pound. Right. There we go.
Sammy, what's yours?
Sammy's gonna have Chapman higher. I'm curious what Sammy's list is gonna be different than all of ours.
So I'm gonna go, first of all, they're all good. None of these are bad. They're all good.
Sammy, the difference here is Sammy remembers Keith Foulke very well. Like Keith Foulke was pitching in like his 40s. So
yes, I remember Keith Foulke. All right, so number five, I'm going to go Koji. Koji was an awesome closer, but I don't love techno music. Not really my thing. Sounds like I don't know. It just sounds like a laptop breaking, like Sandstorm. I don't like that song.
Cold.
Yeah, not my thing. I don't like so. Still a good entrance, but I put that five. Folk, it was a little bit muted compared to the other ones. I'll put him four. Solid entrance. Number three, I'm going to go Kimbrel. I thought the fire stuff was great. Great song. Classic. Throws 100. Beard matches the beard. Pat, that was a good take. I didn't even think of that, but his beard did kind of look like fire. I'm going to go Chapman two because I feel like the entire ballpark is dancing when Carnival comes out. Plus, the Louis Tiant smoking the cigar on the TV is awesome. And with how dominant Chapman's been, it's just chef's kiss. And then Papelbon has to be number one. Shipping up to Boston, your closer in Boston walks out to shipping up to Boston and he's sick. He's maybe the best closer in franchise history or close to it. If not, easy number one. We all agree on the number one. I love that. The point being of this question is the Red Sox have had a lot of great closers over the last 25-ish years or so. I didn't even include Kenley Jansen, who is a little bit up and down, but his song was called Tramp Champions, I think.
He changed it. It was different year one to year two.
You can't do that. Yeah, that got him disqualified for changing it.
DQ'd. So, Yeah.
And you know, four of these guys have won World Series with the Red Sox. Chapman just got to the Red Sox, hasn't even had a chance yet. So we'll see about him. But yeah, man, all good. There's no bad entrance with any of these guys.
How the hell does your adrenaline not go when you hear Sandstorm?
Joe, you can't relate. Like, you can't relate. It's different generations. All right, you can't reason with them.
If it were like more like EDM, where there was big
music entrances back then.
No. If there was more like heavy bass and it was more of like a boom, 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 one of those techno-y songs, I'd be like, all right, this is kind of sick. The whole place is shaking. But Sandstorm kind of sounds like two laptops fucking.
We need to give a shout out. He was not a closer. But the Okajima Okidoki entrance is the greatest entrance of all time for any pitcher on any team.
Wait. I got a contender. Speaking of guys out of Japan, how about Junichi Tozawa's Japanese reggae song?
So good.
Mogera no Uta, baby.
I know the words. I'll sing it to you sometime.
Please don't.
All right. That's going to be a group enough said, which is well worth it. Very good question, Sammy. I appreciated that. That was really good. That's going to do it for episode 262. I didn't look, Joe. Episode 262 of Play Tessie. Appreciate you tuning in. Remember, subscribe, rate 5 stars wherever you get your podcast. Find us on WEI's YouTube channel. Hit the thumbs up. You know the drill. We got the Play Tessie playlist there. It has all our episodes. And then find us at Play Tessie on Twitter, Instagram, and TikTok. For Sammy, for Pat, for Joe producing, it is Gordo here. We're going to be back with another episode tomorrow because it's a little late, you know. Recording at 1:30 a.m. Keep Joe up all night. Now we'll do a post series episode and we'll do a Yankee episode, preview the biggest series of the season. We will be back tomorrow to preview a huge, huge Yankee series. I cannot get enough of this. This is the best. I'm so happy that baseball matters and these series are so important. But here we go. Big series coming up. We'll be back tomorrow. Thanks for tuning in. Peace.
Kevin Stefanski and Andrew Berry, do you think that they are good at what they do?
Yeah, I think so. Well, Stefanski, 2-time coach of the year. Andrew Berry, I don't know. Do we blame the Haslams for the Deshaun Watson debacle?
The questions and the criticisms are more about ownership than anybody on the sideline or in the GM.
He's the head coach of a franchise owned by Jimmy Haslam, so who knows? If you put him in a more stable situation with a less volatile compound in the owner's box, maybe you'd get more.
The Ken Carmen Show with Anthony Lima on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your podcasts.